Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for the third week of April. That's, of course, income tax week for all procrastinators. I'm Nan Evans. My special focus on Nature Now is the natural history of the marine world of the Salish Sea around us. Today, I'll be on the phone with Joe Gatos of the Sea Doc Society to talk about a beautiful and fascinating new book on the Salish Sea. And more about that in a few minutes. But first, as always, we'll start with a mystery sound. And then later on in the program, we'll let you know what it is. So first, let's check out some observations and news, and I've got Charlie Fleischman, our sound engineer, in here to help me with this. Charlie.
Fred Weinman notes that the Cotai Prairie is flowering very early this year. The best show for camas will be in mid to late April, so the next couple weeks will be the best time to pay a visit to the oldest garden in the city, and it is just across the street from the KPTZ radio station.
That's a wonderful little remnant of a prairie. While walking at Old Fort Townsend last week, I spotted a lovely pink fairy slipper, or sometimes it's called a calypso orchid, along the trail. This beautiful little orchid is never common, but is now being threatened by trampling and picking, or just simply the disturbance of its delicate roots. So I advise you to bend down carefully, admire the solitary rose purple slipper-like flower, and inhale its sweet fragrance, and then walk on to see what else you can find.
Last week, birders on the Admiralty Audubon Society field trip along the Larry Scott Trail and Discovery Bay Pond spotted 38 species of birds.
Wow.
Some of the more interesting birds included pileated woodpeckers, northern shovelers, Hutton's vireos, Bewick's wren, and pine siskins.
And Caroline Robertson of the Jefferson Land Trust sent me the following email. She said, "Hooker's ground cone is popping up in the woods right outside my back door just now." Well, that email sent me to my POJAR, that's the author of Plants of the Pacific Northwest, because I had no idea what a hooker's ground cone was. But I know now. It's an oddball plant that parasitizes the roots of salal and other members of the heather family. It's shaped like a cone of a conifer growing out of the ground. It's about 4 or 5 inches tall. It's got yellow to red to purple leaves and flowers. I'll be on the lookout for this plant right now. And speaking of odd, check out recent articles in the Seattle Times and the Peninsula Daily News for the North Pacific Blob. It's a weird oceanic phenomenon that scientists think might be part of the cause of the uncommon weather we've been experiencing these past few years. As I mentioned earlier, I'm on the phone with Joe Gatos of the Sea Doc Society today. And if you don't know about the Sea Doc Society, let me introduce you to this great organization. The Sea Doc Society is actually part of the University of California Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. And located on Orcas Island, the Society works to protect the health of marine wildlife and their ecosystems through science and education. I'm on their monthly e-newsletter, and I love reading it. It's always full of interesting information about projects and findings. And my guest today, he's the director and chief scientist. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks, Nan. Great to be here.
So Joe is the co-author, along with Audrey Benedict, of a spectacular and inspiring new book. It's entitled The Salish Sea, Jewel of the Pacific Northwest. The book was just released on March 31st, 2015. And when I first saw a pre-release copy of the book, I was awestruck by the beauty of the photographs and the layout of the book. And when I later read the book, I was struck again by the poetic and inspiring narrative about this place that I love so deeply. So having Joe on Nature Now just seemed absolutely imperative. And my first question for Joe is, so what was your inspiration for the book?
Well, Nan, I'm actually not from here. I was born a little white kid in West Virginia in the mountains.
Oh, and, Joe, I was born a little white kid in Columbus, Ohio. So
excellent. So you know what it's like when I moved out here with my family in 2001, and I really didn't know much about this area or the Inland Sea, but immediately I fell in love with it, and I was just amazed at everything that was here, and I was amazed at the urban centers that were here as well. And so I just began learning more and more about this area, talking to people, reading things, spending time out on the water, out on the beaches, in the mountains. The impetus for the book was really in the naming of the Salish Sea in 2009. And I thought, man, we really need to have a book about this place, a one-stop shopping guide where people can just sit down and absorb it and be in it as much awe as I was when I first moved out here, but knowing way more than I knew when I first came.
Well, the book is just magic, and that leads me directly into asking you about the name. Because when I was in oceanography graduate school, I left the Midwest and came to the Northwest in the 1970s. No one talked about the Salish Sea. Instead, we studied Puget Sound or the Straits of Juan de Fuca, Georgia Strait, etc. And then when I returned to this area just a few years ago, people were talking about the Salish Sea. Will you share the story of the name with us?
Right. The story really begins probably back in the 1970s. And it started out of a concern. There was a lot of interest in shipping a lot of crude oil and increased marine vessel traffic in the area. That may sound a little bit familiar to you.
Yeah, really.
And at that time, scientists started studying the area. And they said, this place really functions from Olympia all the way north to Campbell River. It really functions as one unit with a major oceanic influence coming down the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And at that time, a scientist at Western Washington University named Bert Weber, he said, we really don't even have a name for this place. And how do we talk about a place and how do we talk about protecting a place when we don't even have a name for it? So in 1989, he went to the Washington Geographic Board of Names and proposed this name, the Salish Sea, in honor of the Coast Salish, who were the first inhabitants in the area. They said, geez, Bert, that's a great idea, but there's really not enough popular usage of that term, Salish Sea. So after a couple of decades, he went back to them in the early 2000s and proposed this name again. And in 2006, the Coast Salish, whose the name is intended to honor, ratified that name at their Coast Salish gathering. Actually, I think it was 2008. And then the following year, Washington Geographic Board of Names, the BC Board of Names, the U.S. Board of Names, and the Canadian Board of Names all adopted this name, the Salish Sea, recognizing it didn't replace Puget Sound or the Strait of Georgia or the Strait of Juan de Fuca, but it was a name for the all-encompassing ecosystem.
And I think it's a great name, and I love the concept of a name for the entire ecosystem because it does function that way. Back to the book for just a second. The subtitle is The Jewel of the Pacific Northwest. Why did you decide to use the term jewel in the title?
Jewel connotes something that you need to take care of, whether it's a family heirloom or a polished stone, something of value. And this is really both. It's something of value, it's something of beauty, and it's something we need to take care of. So it just seemed to fit.
I found a great deal of magic and beauty in the book. Just the critters you were talked about, the bizarre, the beautiful fish. Can you talk a bit about a few of those plants and animals that inspire a sense of wonder in you?
We could start from the invertebrates and move off into the mammals. I always encourage people, find a favorite and talk about it and learn something about it. You know, even from the invertebrates, if you like something that's giant, fall in love with the giant Pacific octopus or the Plumose anemone, the world's largest anemone. Or if you like something that brings money, where the ecosystem brings money back, you know, think about something like the Dungeness crab fishery or the gooey duck fishery, something that is amazing to know that it's out there. Gooey ducks, for instance, can live to be 168 years old, but also amazing because they're a big economic driver for the area. And I would say you could probably work your way through all of the different invertebrates, and there are thousands of different invertebrates that we can see with our eyes, all the way up to the fish. And fish are beautiful in and themselves, but they also have a purpose. They feed us. They feed other things. They bring joy to people that like to watch them while scuba diving. One of the bizarrest groups of fish that we have in the area are definitely the rockfish.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they're in the scorpionfish family, which is kind of a cool thing, not just even for young boys, but they do have a poisonous spines. They have venom that lines the grooves of their dorsal and their anal and their pelvic spines. So they look beautiful. They come in this wide assortment of colors, and then they also have this kind of almost evil aspect of them, this protective value. And then some of them can live to be really, really old. Some of them don't even mature until they're 17 or 18 years old, and other ones like the rough-eye rockfish can live to be over 200 years old. They're an amazing group, and collectively we probably have about 28 different species in the Salish Sea. And then I would say even as far as the birds go, some of my favorite are the diving birds, the alcids. And these are birds that they're not really related, but I call them the northern hemisphere's counterpart to the penguins because they are rarely on land. They're a little bit awkward when they are on land because their feet are pushed so far back on their body. And when they dive under the water, they really fly with their wings underwater and catch fish. Beautiful to watch, and we have a whole bunch of different species. And then what's crazy about that is here you have a bird that spends its whole life almost entirely in the water. Let's say something like a tufted puffin, which was just recently listed as endangered by Washington State. And then when the bird comes to shore, what does it do? It then proceeds to dig a burrow or excavate an old burrow that may be 10 or 15 feet deep. So when it goes on land, it really goes into the land. And these birds will then fly from the burrow out, catch fish, and then fly back. Incredible lifestyles for all of these different fish and birds and invertebrates.
I was reflecting, there was a quote somewhere in the book as well, that tide pools bring out the child in all of us. I love that, because they certainly do for me. And I also was thinking, as you were talking about the birds, there are some wonderful bird photographs in the book. Pigeon guillemots with their bright orange feet just looking silly.
Yeah, and the nice thing about that picture is, you know, one of them is looking over the other guy's shoulder.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, could you move your head a little bit? I'm trying to make a landing here.
Right. And then the picture of the two eagles in their nuptial display. I showed that to a five-year-old the other day, and he couldn't quite get in his head that they were not fighting.
Right. And to see these things lock their feet and go into this spiral down and down and down, just when you think they're going to hit the water, hit the ground, they'll just pull out of it. It's really amazing.
Yeah. So there are scores of just spectacular photographs and really beautiful writing. I'm interested in any particular observations you might have about the sort of fascinating ways that wildlife adapt to their environment. You talked a little bit about birds flying underwater, and I'm thinking about the book talks about the dipper and how it sort of feeds in underwater streams. And you talk about how whales and other mammals can dive so deeply. Tell me a bit about some of your favorite adaptations.
I would say my favorite one, being a veterinarian and being a scuba diver, one of my most favorite one is the ability for marine mammals and marine birds to dive. And it's just counterintuitive that here are animals that breathe air, yet most of their daily life functions are performed underwater where there's no air. How did they do it? Some of it's pretty simple, right? When you dive underwater, you have to stop breathing, because there's nothing to breathe underneath there. But then, if you think about that, your lungs are taking in oxygen and your heart is beating, well, you don't actually need to send blood to your lungs anymore because they're not doing any work. And so their bodies start shifting blood away from certain areas. You don't want to send blood out to your skin because that's just going to make you cold. And so their heart rate slows down, and they're just sending blood to the heart and to the brain. Oxygenate the heart and send a little bit of blood sugar to the brain. And then at the same time, they never go into that lactic acidosis that we do when we exercise anaerobically. They actually have little molecules of oxygen that are stored at the site of the muscle. There's a molecule really close to hemoglobin called myoglobin. And so those muscles are just down there working away, and they have all the oxygen they could want. And then here's the animal. Not only is it down there holding its breath, but it's actually living most of its life out. It's pretty phenomenal.
That is cool. And a lot of them are feeding down there. It is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it really is.
What do you think is the weirdest creature in the Salish Sea?
I would have to say, by far, for me, the giant Pacific octopus.
Oh, yeah.
The more you think about it, the more it's bizarre. I mean, here's an animal, one of the world's largest invertebrates, you know, maybe next to the giant squid, and it can be 150 pounds. And to be so thoughtful about its daily life and intelligent, but really, they're short-lived. They may only live to be 4 or 5 years old.
And they grow so fast.
It's incredible, isn't it? And then when they mate, the female mates once, she may lay 100,000 eggs, and then she'll sit there for 6 or 7 or 8 months and protect those eggs. And then once they hatch out, she dies.
Yeah. So my trivia question for you, of course, is how many suckers are there on an octopus?
That's a great question. And my question to you is male or female?
Right. So I'll say female, and you you can now answer.
Yeah, that makes it easier. So an octopus will have 280 suckers on each of its arms. So that's a total of 2,240 suckers. But on the male, one of his right arms, you know, they have 4 right and 4 left, it's the one he uses to inseminate the female. It only has 100 suckers on it. So it has, the males have 180 left. So I always joke around with people when they, you know, you'll meet someone on an airplane and they'll say, oh, I'm from the Pacific Northwest. I'm from Seattle. I'm from Vancouver. And I'll say, really? And then I'll ask them, how many suckers on a giant Pacific octopus? And when they look at me and they go, male or female? Then I'll say, oh, you really are.
You really are, yeah.
You know that place.
We get that question sometimes down at the Marine Center where we're talking about the giant Pacific octopus, she, the one that's in the tank. And people go, well, how do you know? Well, let me tell you.
Yeah, it's really fun trivia.
What did you learn while writing the book that surprised you the most?
Yeah, so what did I learn that would surprise me the most? I would have to say what I learned was how little I knew. And so as we started putting this together, I thought, well, I've been here 15 years, and I've done a lot of work on a lot of different things, and I've been to a lot of lectures, and I've read a lot of books and scientific papers. And then as we started getting into the writing and getting into telling the stories, I just, every day I was uncovering these new things. And it was so exciting for me, one, because we could get them in the book, but two, I was just like a kid in a candy shop. All this great information that I just had no idea of before.
So I know why the book inspires others. It inspires you, too.
Yeah, that's for sure.
If a reader were to take away only one message from your book, what do you hope that message would be?
Well, I would say that I hope they come away feeling so amazed at the place where we live, so amazed that they want to take care of this place.
That's a great message. I think the book did it for me.
I love hearing that.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for talking with me today about this book. It's, as I said, I'm almost speechless. It is so beautiful and so inspiring. Thank you. Thank you for doing it, and thank you for talking with me.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
Joe will be the keynote speaker for the Port Townsend Marine Science Center annual gathering on May 6th at 7 p.m. at the Commons at Fort Wharton. I know I plan to be there to listen to Joe speak and to see some of his amazing photographs. Well, now let's hear that mystery sound again. Could you hear that double-noted call at the end? Let's listen again. That was the distinctive song of a male ruby-crowned kinglet. These small but vastly energetic, perhaps even frenetic birds can be spotted foraging around the lower branches of shrubs and trees. Smaller than most warblers, the body is gray-green with a white eye ring and a white bar on the wing. If you ever see an excited male, you might be able to see its brilliant red patch on the crown of its head. But don't rely on spotting that ruby crown for identification of the ruby-crowned kinglet. It's usually hidden. Instead, look for the constant flicking of its wings as the key identification clue. Well, what's coming up this week? Let's see. Earth Day is next week. That's Wednesday, April the 22nd. You can show your stewardship for the Earth in many ways. This coming Saturday on April the 18th, help the North Olympic Salmon Coalition plant trees and shrubs to restore riparian habitats along Chimicum Creek. Meet at 9:30 a.m. on Saturday at the Finn River Farm and Cidery. Then Admiralty Audubon and the City of Port Townsend are celebrating Earth Day with trash cleanups and invasive plant removal. Events are going to be held Saturday, April 18th at the Bishop Park, and Sunday, April the 19th at Cotai Lagoon. Check the Admiralty Audubon website. And then on Saturday, April the 25th, join the folks at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center and the Food Co-op for a special Earth Day beach cleanup. Register at the Science Center table at the Food Co-op anytime before 4 p.m. on Saturday. Now, Saturday the 25th, and they'll give you materials to collect trash, assign you a beach, and give you data sheets to record the kinds of trash you collect. That's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news of the natural community where we live. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m., Saturdays at 11:30 a.m., and recent podcasts are also available on the website.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Production coordinator is Mike Schlexer. Today's closing music is The Salish Sea, performed by High Rise Lonesome.